Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in Sociology. I'm Sarah Patterson, one of the hosts here on the channel, and today we're talking with Marie Berry about her book, War, Women, and Power, From Violence to Mobilization in Rwanda and Bosnia. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Sarah.
So to start us off, can you tell us about yourself?
Sure thing. I'm an assistant professor at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. I'm trained as a sociologist. I received my PhD in sociology from UCLA in 2015. And so I'm in my third year as a faculty member here at the University of Denver.
Great. How did this book come about for you?
The book is based, it stems from my dissertation in sociology. It's been the primary project that I've been working on for the better part of the past decade. And to tell you the truth, it actually started before I went to graduate school when I was doing work in Rwanda with a human rights organization. And I began to see all this evidence of the work that women were doing in their communities and the way in which women were mobilizing to join politics and to really to kind of raise their voices in spaces that had been traditionally seen as kind of men's spaces. And I became really interested in exploring this topic at that point. So this was back in 2007 and 2008. And I've been really working on the project ever since.
You start the book off with a really powerful quote. And here, one of your respondents said, it wasn't, you know, in terms of moving forward, it wasn't a choice, it was an obligation. And so I was hoping you could sort of set the stage as you refer to it in the book, as war is a transformative state and sort of women's lived experiences in general.
Absolutely. The quote you're referring to is a quote from a woman named Ignatian, who in 1994 was a housewife living in the south of Rwanda. And when the genocide broke out, her husband, her parents, and many other members of her family were killed. And she found herself alone. And she put it to me like this in an interview. She said, to move forward wasn't a choice. It was an obligation. Either you do it or you die. Either you provide for yourself, your children, or others, or you die. And instead of dwelling on her losses, Ignatian began to focus her energy on helping children in her community. And she managed to go back to school. Eventually, she found a job with UNICEF, where she was working with vulnerable kids. And soon she decided that she wanted to make a bigger impact and ran for office, for political office. Her first campaign was successful. And today, she sits in Rwanda's parliament, which boasts the highest percentage of women legislators of any country in the world. And so when I mentioned that I became interested in this project back in 2007, this was right before the 2008 elections, where Rwandans elected the world's first majority of women to its parliament. And I really became interested in investigating whether or not this incredible mobilization of women in formal political spaces in Rwanda was in spite of the mass violence that the country had experienced just years before, or whether it was in some ways because of the mass violence that the country had experienced in the recent past. And so I embarked on this project in an attempt to unpack this relationship between war and women's political mobilization, and became interested in looking at this as a trend across the world. And much recent research has actually revealed something, you know, very surprising, which is that countries that have experienced war across the globe have, on average, higher levels of women in their legislatures than countries that have not experienced violence. This is really work by Eileen Tripp and Melanie Hughes, who have been looking into the way in which war can sometimes open these unexpected opportunities for women to claim increased rights and political power in their aftermath. And so the book really begins in many ways with the obvious, this idea that war is profoundly destructive. It devastates societies, as we know, and it ruins lives, ruptures economic systems, and lays waste to infrastructure in myriad ways. And most coverage of war has typically featured women as particularly harmed by violence. And we oftentimes see images of women weeping, wringing hands, oftentimes positioned as victims of sexual violence, of homelessness, of abuse, and of this untenable task of caring for children and the elderly in the aftermath of war. And so this recent research that reveals this relationship between war and women's increased political mobilization is quite surprising. And this is the puzzle that generates the theoretical premise of the book, which is really that while war is destructive, it is also a period of rapid social transformation in which institutions, social structures, and gender relations can be in flux.
Yeah, something that I really liked about the book is that you really focus on women's lived experiences, and I find that to be a really powerful aspect of the whole book. And I was sort of curious, how did you actually choose these two countries, and sort of what were your methods to gather data?
Absolutely. Well, the book, over the past really 9 years that I've been conducting field research for the book, it was a tremendous privilege to be able to sit down with more than 260 women in both Rwanda and in Bosnia throughout the course of the research. I initially designed this as a, and I talk about this in the book a bit, I actually designed this as a paired case comparative study, which aimed to investigate a successful case of women's political mobilization after violence, which is the case of Rwanda. And then what I saw initially as a negative case, or the case of Bosnia, where women were not included in formal political spaces in the aftermath of violence, and in fact experienced a retreat or a decline in their political representation in the years in the immediate aftermath of violence. But what actually happened as I set out and was conducting the interviews and was doing the research was something that was a bit surprising and complicated this initial setup in terms of its kind of positive negative case design. While I had, read many kind of summaries of the low levels of women's political representation in Bosnia, and had seen many accounts celebrating the liberation of Rwandan women, and of course the political empowerment of Rwandan women, the reality in both cases is much more complicated. And so as I was conducting the research, two things really became clear. One is that in Bosnia, this was not simply a negative case. There was a tremendous amount of grassroots informal political mobilization in Bosnia by women during and in the immediate aftermath of the war. And this political agency and political mobilization did not look necessarily like women's participation in formal politics. It oftentimes took the form of women interacting in their communities in novel ways, testifying about their experience during violence and about their sexual assault, oftentimes in front of courts, lobbying governments for rights and resources and access to information about their loved ones, where their loved ones had been buried in many cases. And thus, this idea that Bosnia represented a negative case in many ways was incorrect. What I found was that if we expand our understanding and definition of what women's political agency looks like, we see how war fostered similar processes of women's political mobilization in both Rwanda and Bosnia. Now, the second kind of main point to be made here about the case selection is that Rwanda also is not as clear a case of a positive story of women's political representation and political power as one might see at first glance. Rwanda has received accolades for years about their strong support of women's political representation and gender equality throughout all of kind of branches of government, and the way in which the constitution was rewritten in the aftermath of violence, and the way in which institutions and policies have been kind of reformulated to place gender equality at their core. Now, the reality is that Rwanda is not a democratic country, and the tremendous level of women in Rwanda's political space does not reflect solely the political empowerment of women. In many ways, as I talk about at some length in the book, the level of women in Rwanda's parliament in particular has been used by the political regime to distract attention from the regime's authoritarian practices more broadly. And moreover, the legislature in Rwanda simply does not have the level of political power that one might expect it to have in a democratic setting. So the pair-case comparison in many ways was a setup that allowed that I departed from quite a bit, and that when I was doing the interviews, I was challenged to expand my understanding of what women's political participation looks like, to look beyond the formal legislative representation of women, and to look at the grassroots, to the ways that women were organizing in their households and in their communities to create change and to advocate for their rights outside of formal political channels. And that it also required me to ask a question about whether women's inclusion is a reasonable and quality indicator of women's political power. And these are topics that I get, you know, I deal with much more in depth in the book. And I'll say just briefly about the interviews that the book is based on. More than 260 women that I interviewed for this project, I attempted to speak with women, and what I kind of talked about is three categories, although really in the end it was more like two categories. And I designed the study initially to interview women that were political elites, so women, mayors, ministers, members of parliament, and so forth. And then I was also interested in interviewing women that had been involved with founding civil society organizations or held leadership positions in community organizations. And then the sort of third category of women that I was interested in targeting were non-elites or kind of quote-unquote ordinary women. And these women were farmers, they were market vendors, they were sex workers, they were retirees, they were factory supervisors. They came from a range of different backgrounds in the two countries. And so the research really consisted of was me asking them all these different kind of women with these different backgrounds how war shaped their lives. And I mean, they told me incredible stories, and the stories are really what motivates this book.
Great. Thank you for that. So to start off with, you start with Rwanda. So I was hoping you could sort of give us a brief history that you provide, not as extensive as you provide in the book, but sort of set the stage for what was happening in Rwanda.
Of course. So the story of the Rwandan genocide is quite well known, I think, at this point. What I do in the book is I try to trace the way in which women were involved in Rwandan history, obviously very involved, over the course of the past century and a half. And so I look at the changing roles that women held in their households and in their communities and at the national political level from the pre-colonial through the colonial to the post-colonial era. And of course, the point of departure for the study is really the war and genocide, which broke out in Rwanda in 1990 with the invasion of the Rwandan Patriotic Front, which was a rebel army that had formed in Uganda. And that set off a series of violent years throughout the country where armed conflict occurred across the country with different dynamics and logics and speeds at different points in time. The genocide itself began in April of 1994 when a plane carrying a president, Habyarimana, crashed or was shot down in Kigali as it attempted to land. And over the course of the next few months, there was a tremendous and horrific outbreak of violence, which targeted at its beginning various people from different political parties, including Hutus, but rapidly the Tutsis in Rwanda became associated with the Rwandan Patriotic Front, which was a primarily Tutsi rebel army, and thus Tutsis became to be painted as the enemy. And so all Tutsi civilians then became targets of factions within the remnants of Habyarimana's regime. And so what unfolded over the next few months was the most rapid and horrific kind of period of mass atrocities in recent history. And we see, throughout the book and throughout so many other scholars' excellent research on Rwanda, how women were particularly targeted and particularly made vulnerable by this period of violence through sexualized violence, through rape, and through a tremendous amount of brutality. And so what I begin by looking at kind of in the next chapter is really how the destruction and devastation of that period of violence, really between 1990 throughout the end of 1994, created conditions that were so difficult for ordinary Rwandans to live that it became necessary, as Ignatian's story told us a few minutes ago, it became very necessary for women to take the responsibility for securing basic material needs for their families, food, water, shelter, healthcare, and so forth. And that what I describe in the coming kind of chapters is how that the urgency, the pressing urgency of those urgent needs led women outside of kind of traditional roles and even physical spaces that they had been confined in many ways before, to push them to interact with others in their communities who face similar challenges, and really, in many ways, created conditions of life that required action to begin to be able to survive. And so the important part of the historical chapter on Rwanda is really that we see a shift in the way in which women were able to interact with international organizations, interact with local government, even create new social networks and new sort of forms of social coping in their communities in the aftermath of violence. So that shift in roles from prior to the violence to post-violence is what catalyzes this process of women's mobilization throughout the country.
Yeah, I really like how you sort of break it down in chapter three into three shifts. So you've got demographic shifts, economic shifts, and cultural shifts. So I was hoping you could talk more about those three aspects.
Yeah, absolutely. So the primary argument of the book is that war catalyzed really three interlapping and overarching shifts. The first is a demographic shift, which was based on the displacement of a huge percentage of the population from their homes, in addition to the disproportionate death, conscription, and imprisonment, really, of men in the aftermath of the violence. And what I argue is that this demographic shift led women to create new social networks as displacement forced people into new routines and to new modes of social interaction. And because of the absence of men, which put traditional gender roles within the household into flux. I then talk about a second shift, which was an economic shift triggered really by the massive economic kind of or macroeconomic collapse during war and exacerbated by the corresponding destruction of infrastructure and agricultural capacity. And so this in Rwanda meant that fields went fallow and women who had been primarily self-subsistence agriculturalists prior to the violence were forced to go off of their household plots of land to find food in new spaces because they weren't able to tend crops during the duration of the violence. And so this economic shift really led to urgent material needs among the population for food, water, shelter, and medical care, which, as I said before, which catalyzed the formation of thousands of informal self-help groups to meet these urgent material and really emotional needs. And I argue that these community organizations formalized and institutionalized a system of women's leadership at the grassroots level. And they formalized in large part because of a process of institutional isomorphism, where international NGOs that came, that were humanitarian NGOs or development NGOs that came and arrived in the country in the aftermath in an attempt to help the country transition from war to stability, modeled this kind of formal organizational structure, which then led to the replication of that formal structure amongst these more emergent grassroots organizations. And so I argue that this kind of institutionalization of the system of women's leadership at the grassroots level helped women develop self-reliance, encourage profit-making activities, and really facilitated a shift also in how women controlled surplus income. So oftentimes, especially in the Rwandan case, we see women who actually hadn't had much of an interaction with cash before the violence. And then in the aftermath, because of the destruction of agriculture, we see the need to actually purchase food and to have control over cash income or the kind of distribution of cash from international NGOs. I argue then that there was a third shift, which is like this cultural shift. And this in Rwanda was a reflection of the fact of a couple things, but one was this reflection of the fact that women's participation in community organizations became increasingly common during the war and in the aftermath. And as such, this sort of cultural understanding of who constituted a legitimate public actor shifted. So this idea that in kind of prior to the violence, as one of my interviewees said, you know, politics was like a male bedroom. It was really just for them, right? In the aftermath, there was this idea that that I think is a challenging one to deal with, especially for myself as somebody with an orientation in feminist scholarship. This idea that women were more peaceful than men was really juxtaposed by the women themselves with men's propensity for violence. And this idea in Rwanda, but also in Bosnia, that women had not been responsible for the bad politics that had brought about the violence to begin with. And, this doesn't take away from the fact that many women were complicit in the violence and that many women also perpetrated genocide in Rwanda, although at a much, much, much smaller and lower level than men. But this idea here was that this cultural shift allowed for women to increasingly raise their voices and emerge as legitimate leaders, even of informal community organizations. And I think that when we look at that shift in conjunction with the economic shift and the demographic shift, we see these three shifts leading to this informal political mobilization of women, which I talk about as this fourth major shift, which is really the core argument of the book, is that the combination of demographic, economic, and cultural shifts facilitated or precipitated the increased mobilization of women in their households, in their communities, and then with the arrival of a regime that was interested in promoting women for a variety of kind of other reasons, we see the formalization of women's political mobilization in Rwanda in particular.
What I found was really interesting is that a lot of these groups, as you point out in chapter 4, started out like basically as informal support groups, right? Like they were looking for support from each other, and then they sort of developed into these income generating groups and these other grassroots groups and NGOs and things like that. So I was hoping you could sort of talk about that progression.
Absolutely. So The book tries to center the stories of individual women. So maybe I can answer that question in some ways by telling you about some of these women that I spoke with. For instance, there was a woman named Noemi who was born in the south of Rwanda in the early 1960s. And I start chapter four with a story. She had attended university. She had majored in sociology, actually, and she was married and became a teacher. And when the genocide broke out in 1994, her husband was killed. And so she described to me, she said, you know, with a tremendous amount of frustration, she says, I was married to a successful man. I thought he would give me anything to do anything for me. But after the genocide, it was different because my husband was dead and I was the head of the house. So I had to do everything that was the same for the kids as when their dad was around. I wanted them to have the same things when only I am around. Now, Noemi talks about how she joined a widow's organization in the aftermath of the violence. And for 3 years after 1994, she worked really hard for that organization. And as she put it, people really getting to know me. So people in her community then approached her and encouraged her to join politics. And she described to me how she really used to hate politics. She said, I thought politics was just a bunch of lies. But in the aftermath of the genocide and the aftermath of the death of her husband, she described how she was really motivated to make a difference. And so she thought about it and she said, all right, well, why can't I join politics and start to try to help out my country? And so she began this process of running for office and started off at the very local level in a sector position. And then she went on to kind of become the mayor of this small area. And then eventually, kind of years later, she now sits in parliament. So this transition in Noemi's life from being a teacher to being a member of parliament, I argue, exemplifies the way that war can serve as a period of rapid transformation in ordinary women's lives. With her level of education in particular and her status as a widow, she was biographically well positioned to take this leadership role all the way from the grassroots up to the national political realm. And so while Noemi's story is sort of this, it illustrates in many ways this very, very kind of formal process of women's political mobilization or political power, I would say that her experience is not typical. Thousands of other Rwandan women also experienced shifts in their political engagement that manifested in less formal political spaces during and after the violence. So I talk a lot about kind of this process through which women who identified the need for basic support, whether it was emotional support or financial support, how this catalyzed a decision to seek out others in their communities where they could actually find that support. And sometimes, you know, one woman I spoke with described that the biggest thing she needed in the aftermath of the violence was iron sheets for the roof of her house. You know, she was fairly well off and fairly well positioned, but she needed something to keep the rain out of her house, quite literally. And, you know, before the war, she described how this would have been something that was her husband's job, you know, that her husband would have been in charge of finding the roof, but her husband was dead. And so for her, it became a process of trying to navigate an entirely new kind of a social reality, whereby she had to find out how to afford metal sheets, how to actually install them on the roof of her house, where to find the support to do so, and so on. And so she joined together with other women in her community who had the same need. And they formed this very kind of informal organization where we began to petition this international NGO that had a feeding program, I believe, in that community or nearby. They began to petition actual representatives from that international NGO to give them these iron sheets that they needed for their houses. And eventually they were successful. They received the iron for their roofs. And then because of the success, they felt emboldened and encouraged that if they potentially actually named their organization and created a leadership structure where one of them was appointed president, one was appointed vice president, and so on, if they wrote a mission statement and so forth, they could actually register formally as an organization that could then apply to various grant opportunities from international NGOs. And then this process of sort of needing something so basic as a roof for one's house, then catalyzed these women in particular to really get engaged with others in their community and work together. And then this organization that resulted became a organization that could work more broadly on more broad issues. So not just on economic needs of women, but actually could begin to lobby for women's rights, could be a space for psychosocial therapy and other sort of, grief and trauma, counseling and conversations around loss and so forth. And so this process of kind of mobilization happens, I argue, through these informal emergent self-help organizations. And that process is really the key process that allows for women's engagement kind of in new roles during and in the aftermath of widespread atrocities.
So then in the second half of the book, you move on to Bosnia. And so I was hoping you could sort of provide a similar history for us so that we can understand the setting that this is happening in.
Absolutely. So, of course, you know, I again attempt one of my goals in writing this book was to provide enough history of both of the cases so that the book could be assigned to classes without any additional context on either of these cases. So there's quite a bit of historical overview of the Bosnia case as well. And again, I trace the status of women in Bosnian history through the last century and a half and focus primarily on shifts in women's roles and women's status during the period of Yugoslavia, and then during the transition away from a socialist system of governance towards the reforms that came after Bosnia and Croatia and Slovenia's independence in the early 1990s, which of course triggered the war that then followed. One of the things that is important to note in the Bosnian case is that the war had many different dynamics in different parts of the country. And so in both Rwanda and in Bosnia, I have three primary sites where I did the majority of the field work. And so in the capital cities in both countries, I have a large percentage of my interviews in the capital cities, but I also focus on two rural sites, or not rural sites, but two other sites in both cases. So in Bosnia, I look at the area around Prijedor, which is in the Krajina region of kind of northwestern Bosnia. Then I also look at the Drina Valley and specifically look at the people from the area around Potočari and Srebrenica that were then pushed towards Tuzla and other parts of Bosnia because of the massive ethnic cleansing that unfolded along the Drina Valley. And so I describe in many ways the ways in which women were made particularly vulnerable during the war in Bosnia through, again, sexualized violence and other forms of harm, along with how sex selective massacres in Bosnia really characterized much of the violence. And this meant that way more men died in Bosnia than women during the war. And this is different from Rwanda. In Rwanda, 56% of the dead in Rwanda were men, but in Bosnia that number was perhaps as high as 90%. And so what we see in as a result of the war in Bosnia is this massive sort of demographic imbalance of a loss of men, not just through disproportionate death, but also through this disproportionate mobilization of men in armed groups throughout the period of time around the war. And so many men that were conscripted needed to go and fight in the war, leaving behind their families and women oftentimes to care for in the very kind of traditional sort of expected gender roles to care for children and the elderly. I talk in the historical chapter about the differences and the different dynamics of violence in different parts of the country before shifting towards the next chapter, where, like in Rwanda, I talk about the demographic, economic, and cultural shifts that occurred as a result of the war in Bosnia. And what was so interesting to me is that I began the Bosnia research a couple years after I had been doing the Rwanda research. And what I found was surprisingly similar between the cases, and that because of this sort of urgent needs that women faced during and the immediate aftermath of violence. We see this mushrooming of emergent grassroots community organizations, oftentimes led by women and oftentimes for women, designed to secure food, water, shelter, healthcare, a space for grief, a space for helping each other, a space for generating momentum to begin to lobby elected officials, international actors, the UN, and so forth for things like information about where their loved ones were buried. And so, you know, like I kind of talked about Ignatian at the beginning, there are many stories of women in Bosnia that exemplify a similar process. I talk about, for instance, just one woman named Kada, who was a factory employee during the war. And she became separated from her family during the bloodshed. And she said how she was just full of questions during the war. And she was constantly questioning, you know, where are these people that I love? You know, are they alive? Are they in prison? Where are they? And these questions motivated her to join together with others that had the same questions about their loved ones. And so Kata talked about when the war came to an end, she realized that her worst fears were likely true. Both her husband and her son had been killed during the violence. And she was from the region around Srebrenica. And so she described how she joined together with others who feared the worst, but who had not actually located the bodies of their loved ones. And so they began to lobby the government for information. Kata told me, you know, at one point she believed that protests were the only way to be heard. And so she organized with other women to use their shared grief to demand that politicians revealed the locations of their loved ones' bodies. And there were many missing in Bosnia still to this day, over 1,000 people still that have not been found since the violence. I interviewed many members of the organization Kata is a part of, which is a very well-known organization now. And this other woman described how, at the beginning of the war, we were just housewives and we were raising kids and our husbands were in charge of providing food for us. But today, she said, every powerful person that comes to Bosnia wants to talk to us. So these, like the stories in Rwanda, these stories in Bosnia complicate these narratives that depict women only as the victims and spoils of war. And so really this book is designed to kind of better explore and to theorize how women like Ignatian, like Kata, and like so many other women I spoke with experienced war, bear kind of witness to its effects, and then exert agency and power in ways that are so often obscured by journalistic coverage and by conventional scholarship on women in war.
Well, it's kind of interesting, like in chapter 6, you talk a lot about displacement, but also new social networks, right? Like these women were making new social networks. And something I found really interesting also from that chapter was that you said NGOs were actually non-existent or basically non-existent in Bosnia before the war, and women really led that change there. So I was hoping you could talk more about that.
Absolutely. So during the socialist era in Bosnia, or I should say in Yugoslavia, and most NGOs that existed were part of the political fabric of the country. So they were tightly tied to the government, and they were not autonomous civil society organizations. And then what we see during the war and in the aftermath of the war, and really through the end of the 1990s, is this rapid formation of community-based organizations in Bosnia that I argue eventually comprise a parallel power structure to that of the state, where organizations that are seen as non-governmental actually take on many of the same responsibilities that a state might normally provide, like providing healthcare, like providing schools, like providing psychosocial trauma support, and so forth. So these organizations became at the forefront of many of the peace building efforts, of the transitional justice efforts, and of the kind of reconciliation efforts in the aftermath of war, and they really represented a departure from the past. Now, there's no good data that exists on how many organizations really did form in either Rwanda or Bosnia during the violence. And yet there are quite a few studies that sort of posit these estimates. And the estimates are massive. In Rwanda, some of the estimates are that some were like 50,000 organizations had formed in the aftermath of the war. And in Bosnia, the estimates are a bit better. And they suggest that upwards of 1,600 or so organizations formed throughout the course of the war and in the aftermath. And as I describe in this book, the catalyst for the formation of many of these organizations was oftentimes around something very informal, the need to secure something like the iron sheets that I mentioned prior. In Bosnia, there was so much displacement, you know, about 50% of the population was displaced from their homes. And this led women to actually be congregating or, you know, even be, you know, sleeping and living in completely different social quarters than they would have been living in before. So you have women living in schools as they are displaced. Schools were turned into IDP camps. Or you have people congregated along refugee camps in the border, across the border in Croatia, or some, you know, in the area around Zagreb in Croatia as people fled Bosnia during the armed conflict. And what I found were so many stories of women living in these situations of displacement, talking about how boredom was a real thing. You know, there was this need to survive and secure basic goods for one's family. But then women that had been lawyers, who had been teachers, who had been farmers prior to their displacement, found themselves idle. And so oftentimes this catalyzed a sense of well, what can we do to pass the time, to distract ourselves from the fear and the worry about what happened to our loved ones, and to begin to actually establish some degree of normalcy in our lives and in our children's lives and so forth going forward. And so a lot of these organizations did everything from, you know, needlework projects and knitting to a very ambitious, they actually, you know, political projects where there was an attempt. One of the organizations I talk about at some length in the book began really in a refugee camp in Croatia, and quite interestingly, I think, strategically framed itself from the beginning as a women's organization that was apolitical. And this organization oftentimes talked about the fact that they were not engaged in a political project. What they wanted to do is just live and to bring beauty back into the areas where they had been displaced from. So as members of this organization began to return to their homes that had been destroyed during the war, and actually began to return to a small town outside of Priador, which was now under the Dayton Accords that ended the war in Bosnia and divided the state into two entities, the Federation, and then what is called Republika Srpska. So there's sort of the Bosniak and Croat Federation occupies 51% of the territory, and then the Republika Srpska occupies 49% of the territory. And so there's completely separate governance structures, although there's also a national level government as well. But so this particular women's organization wanted to return to their hometown, which was part of the country that was under Republika Srpska. So it was under control of Serb authorities. And these women were Bosniak women. So they were Bosnian Muslim women. And they did this very interesting thing, I think, and really a powerful thing that they still do to this day, which is that they actually repopulated this town and began to erect memorials and symbols of their loss, which would be seen as incredibly political and incredibly provocative in the current kind of political climate in that part of the country. But because they framed it as being women's work, they were able to sort of strategically use this kind of gendered essentialist idea of women's kind of non-political or apolitical or more peaceful nature to actually engage in a highly contentious political project, which was about refugee resettlement and ethnic resettlement within a kind of a politically contentious zone. So I talk, you know, that's just one of many examples of kind of the range of topics and the range of ways in which organizations that formed during and after the war really did shape the dynamics of that transition from war to peace, and they served as the primary site through which women engage in what I call political mobilization.
Oh, that's great, because that leads to my next question, which is actually about political mobilization. And here you also had a really powerful quote from, I think her name is pronounced Nora, a widow. And she said, our pain organized us. And I thought that that was such a powerful way to present that. And so I was hoping you could talk about this sort of political mobilization in Rwanda and Bosnia.
Absolutely. You know, in the book, I draw on a theoretical perspective that draws heavily from Laila Abu-Lugod, from Asaf Bayat, and really from James Scott as well, where I talk about how the ordinary activities of a subaltern, of kind of ordinary people, can be political, even if they don't look like our understanding of formal politics, but they can accumulate kind of like stepping stones to achieve some sort of political change. And so, you know, in both Rwanda and Bosnia, this process of political mobilization that I'm interested in is the way in which women eroded expectations of their gendered roles, the way in which they challenged existing patriarchal structures, the way in which they lobbied for their increased rights and visibility in spaces where they had been sidelined in the past. And I think that what became so clear throughout the course of this project is that in both cases, we see the way in which war catalyzed women's political mobilization through these sort of daily kind of shifts in their lives, and the new burdens and expectations that they faced as a result both of the kind of cataclysmic violence and destruction during the wars, but also as a result of these demographic, economic, and cultural shifts related to kind of women's power. And you know, Nora's comment that you mentioned about how our pain organized us was a theme that links so many of my interviews together. I think it's important to emphasize that throughout the book and throughout my research, it was not to say that women were grateful for these opportunities and these increased opportunities for political participation or kind of agency. Oftentimes there was a true sense of frustration and horrendous loss. And difficulty. Life is so difficult for so many women in Rwanda and Bosnia today. And the idea that their political fortitude and political mobilization stem so directly from loss and from pain, I think is an important way to nuance and to caution the kind of overarching kind of simple read of the argument I make in this book. The way in which pain organizes can actually be, it can take myriad forms. I talk in the book about, you know, one Rwandan woman who, after losing her husband, talked about how survival at home is just a hassle. You know, you become a father and a mother. She was so frustrated about this new responsibility. She, while it had pushed her into these new community organizations and had actually led this particular woman to hold a leadership role, in a formal political leadership role, this was not something that she saw as an opportunity. She was very frustrated by it. In Bosnia, a woman that I interviewed actually several times over the course of this research, and I still talk to often. Described, I remember sitting at her house for an entire afternoon where she described the agony of searching for her son's remains. And this woman was one of the few women who was imprisoned at Omarska concentration camp in Bosnia, which was one of the most kind of infamous and brutal concentration camps during the Bosnian War. And she was subjected to numerous forms of torture, including rape during her captivity there. Yet she never wanted to talk about that with me. What she always wanted to talk about was her son and how she had not found her son's remains. And she described how every single time a mass grave is discovered in Bosnia, she actually quite literally drives to the location and runs to the grave and has at times tried to dig through the dirt with her own hands, hoping beyond all hope that she's going to be able to find her son's remains. And this this idea of this deep pain, this idea that, you know, this woman won't even speak to the suffering she experienced, because as she put it so many times to me, that pales in comparison to the suffering that she feels as a result of not having a grave to go to, not having bones to pray over and to fully sort of allow her mourning to come full circle. I mean, that is what forced really this woman to join together with others to protest government corruption and government refusal to actually systematically track down where these graves might be located. It caused her she fled and lived for many years outside of Bosnia, but comes back every year to maintain ties to the land so that she can find some sort of peace, really, with this feeling of disconnection that she feels because of this kind of lack of knowing around what happened to her son. So the heaviness that was present in so many of the interviews that I conducted with so many of these women, I think, you know, is absolutely what drives so much of their kind of political mobilization and political agency. But it is also what I think must be kind of centered in any sort of conversation around the impact of war on women, because it really was. Remarkably and overwhelmingly sad.
And then in chapter 8, you sort of bring this up in terms of that even though, you know, these women were able to mobilize in many, many positive ways, they also had some limitations. There were limitations in terms of what you talk about as the hierarchies of victimhood or even backlash against what they were doing. So I was hoping you could talk about those.
Absolutely. So, you know, in the first two thirds of the book, I really explore this idea of how war can create unexpected opportunities for women to engage in their communities and their households and in the national kind of political space in new ways as a result of the war. But in chapter 8, as you note, I talk about how much of this progress and many of the gains that women did make were undermined by what I talk about is three things, three processes, which are in no way the only three things that undermined or kind of fractured women's organizing, but three things that came to the forefront of my interviews. And this is really the subject of a lot of my research since this project. Is kind of further understanding the ways in which seemingly emancipatory strategies or policies or women's empowerment efforts can create new and unintended forms of oppression. And I think that chapter 8 in many ways is the most important chapter of the book. And it is the one that really cautions against an easy reading of the earlier parts of the book, which really look at kind of war as a period of social transformation for gender roles. So I argue in chapter 8 that three things undermined it set back women's progress. The first was the structure of the political settlement, which, you know, included in Rwanda the military victory of the Rwandan Patriotic Front, a primarily Tutsi army, and in Bosnia included the Dayton Accords, which was a formal peace process, of course, orchestrated by the international community that completely shut women out of the negotiations. And in both of these political settlements, what we see is the creation of a simplified narrative of violence, which allows particular groups to be seen as victims and particular groups to be seen as perpetrators. And these simplified categories map onto ethnic categories, which is a way of flattening the complexity of the lived experience that so many people had during the armed conflict itself. And so, for instance, in Rwanda, what we see is the direct connection between being Tutsi and being a survivor, and being Hutu and being seen as suspicious or as guilty of criminal behavior during the genocide. And this gets codified in myriad ways in the aftermath of the violence. It gets codified through the way in which the regime itself actually says that one has to have, you get certified as being a survivor, and this entitles you to particular benefits, entitles you, you know, to social welfare benefits, education benefits, other forms of psychosocial support and aid. And yet these, that being a survivor required that one was Tutsi. And the problem with this is that it completely eliminates the forms of suffering experienced by non-Tutsis during and the aftermath of the violence. And I talk about in the book, and much of the recent scholarship on Rwanda, you know, expands upon this much more kind of in much more depth. But the genocide occurred in Rwanda alongside a war in which the Rwandan Patriotic Front was complicit in many atrocities. And so there are many Hutu Rwandans that suffered tremendously during the war. And so by denying them an ability to even mourn their dead in public, by denying Hutu survivors of violence an ability to grieve, to access services, to testify in court about their own suffering or the loss of their own loved ones or the injustices that members of their family experienced during the violence, we've created a hierarchy of victimhood in Rwanda, which allows for particular forms of grief to be seen as salient and other ones not. And what I argue in this case, and in a similar process unfolded in Bosnia as well, is that this worked to fracture women's organizing by dividing women that maybe during and in the kind of in the immediate aftermath of violence had a lot of shared interests around their kind of urgent material needs and other shared gender interests in the more, you know, legal or policy realm around the need to advocate or lobby for inheritance rights or to advocate for reform of some of the family law provisions. Instead, what happened was that women's organizations that had formed had to become monoethnic to be able to even maintain their viability or secure any sort of international aid. And so we see basically the Tutsification of Rwandan civil society in the aftermath of the genocide, where Hutu women's experiences were actually actively suppressed, or I should say Tutsi women's organizing was actively suppressed for a variety of reasons. And in Bosnia, you know, just to kind of summarize the main point here, I talk about a hierarchy of victimhood, which had similar ethnic ties in Bosnia, in which Bosniak or Bosnian Muslim Bosnian Muslims were seen as the kind of primary victims, and Serbs were seen as the primary aggressors, which of course again flattens many of the logic of violence throughout the course of the war. And the other thing that happened in Bosnia was kind of twofold. One was the elevation of women with particular victim identities over other women. So this is women that were widows, women that were survivors, and primarily women that were survivors of rape or mothers of those that had been killed. And so whereas many of the organizations that I spoke with some of the founders of, these organizations that had formed during it and in the immediate aftermath of the war had actually consisted of women with different war experiences. So they had women that, you know, that had, you know, not lost anyone in their family, women that had fled very early on and had spent the war in Belgium, but had come back, you know, or it had been, in, you know, kind of come back to the refugee camps at some point. Together with women that had survived rape, together with women that had, you know, survived displacement, together with women that had lost sons or husbands during the war. The way in which, and this kind of gets to the second major part of the argument in this chapter 8, but the way in which the political settlement and international humanitarian aid intervened in the aftermath of the war in Bosnia privileged particular victim identities over others. And so we see how funding was really allocated to organizations that targeted or that were primarily comprised of women that were raped or women that were mothers or wives of those men that had been killed. And so this created incentives for these organizations to actually kick out some of the women that didn't have experiences of rape or of loss in the same way. And I should say that the kind of the other element to this is that we also see in the Bosnian case an elevation of the massacre at the genocide at Srebrenica over all other sort of episodes of violence throughout the war. And so I talk a bit about the comparison between the international aid and attention that's gone to Srebrenica in the aftermath of the war and that continues to this day in comparison to the attention that's been given to the Prijedor region or the Krajina region, which also suffered tremendous amounts of loss and ethnic cleansing and brutality during war and yet has not been called a genocide by the international community nor by a series of kind of court decisions. And thus what we see is Srebrenica, which is kind of widely considered to be this classic case of genocide within the Bosnian War, gets much more attention, elevating the status of those victims over victims from the Prijedor area. And I talk about how, beyond the moral and ethical dilemmas that are at play in that process and the complicity of international actors in constructing these hierarchies, what is really the result at the end of the day is that much of the organizing that women were doing fractured, and there were all these barriers that were put up for women to be able to organize cross-ethnically and even cross-country, cross-regionally, because of the kind of these hierarchies that emerged, which devoted resources and attention towards particular groups at the expense really of others, and thus silenced others, other experiences of violence. So that is a bit of a long answer to the kind of first part of chapter 8. And I'll just quickly say about the two other things. One was the second element, which, you know, is tied to this construction of hierarchies of victimhood, is the way in which the arrival of international humanitarian aid in both cases privileged particular interventions that did not center the lived experiences or the voices or expertise or knowledge of women in either Rwanda or Bosnia in the aftermath of violence. And as a result, created incentives or initiatives that actually undermined much of the work that women were already doing in their communities, and thus limited the ability for these nascent and emergent women-led organizations to fully formalize and become viable actors in civil society, which I argue would better support transitions from war to peace in the future if women's organizations were given better platforms and power to make determinations about, for instance, about how international aid is allocated at the local level. There's much more to say about that, but I'll just quickly say that the third part of the argument in chapter 8 is about a revitalization of patriarchy in the aftermath of armed conflict. I talk a bit about how patriarchal expectations and the patriarchal status quo in many ways is in flux during periods of armed conflict. And this is because of the kind of demographic, economic, and cultural shifts that I talk about during the earlier parts of the book. But in the aftermath of armed conflict, as feminist scholars have been detailing for years, there is this hardening and kind of a reemergence of patriarchal expectations, pushing women back into the home, and once again seeing kind of the militarized kind of ethos of masculinity as a form of post-war sort of legitimacy, and thus this kind of growing and increasing sort of marginalization of the way in which women's kind of assertion that they were more peaceful actors during the war, the way in which that becomes sidelined kind of as the years go on in the aftermath. And of particular interest, and I think of particular importance, is the way in which we see in both cases, although pre-war baselines, I should say, are extremely difficult to identify, related to domestic violence, we do see a lot of evidence in both cases of an uptick in gender-based violence or intimate partner violence in the aftermath of the wars in both cases. And this is a result, you know, of many things, including, you know, trauma, including the increased availability of weapons. And for many of my interview respondents, something that came up often was the increased use of alcohol and drugs in the aftermath of war by their spouses and male family members. And so in my interviews, what came out so profoundly is that actually many of the women that were beginning to be the loudest voices for women's rights in their communities, or who were really beginning to kind of actually stake claims about the importance of women's leadership in politics or in community life, that these women were actively sort of policed by intimate partners or by others in their communities, where they were threatened and kind of pushed back in some ways into kind of more traditional expected gender roles in the aftermath. And so I caution that these three things, the way in which political settlements creates hierarchies of victimhood, the way in which international humanitarian aid fails to center the knowledge and expertise of women at the grassroots, and the way in which patriarchy can be revitalized in the aftermath of war and actually reflect the sort of patriarchal backlash to women's gains, that these three things combined to undermine in many ways the political mobilization that did emerge during and after the wars in both Rwanda and in Bosnia.
To sort of wrap up your book here for us, in the conclusion, you sort of point back to the three shifts that you mentioned earlier, which are like the demographic shifts, economic shifts, and cultural shifts. And something else that I really liked about your conclusion chapter was you point out some theoretical contributions as well. So I was hoping you could give us some takeaways in terms of the book overall, but also in terms of thinking about these issues theoretically.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the book, as to, in terms of the theoretical takeaways of the book, I really aimed, the book, you know, the title of the book is a kind of a play on Tilly, this idea of from mobilization to revolution. And you know, what I talk about in the subtitle of the book, from violence to mobilization, in many ways is a way of attempting to kind of look through a historical institutionalist framework about the way in which this period of kind of massive upheaval can create institutional change in the long run. And I think that while this book focuses on looking at the way in which war can structure kind of change around the kind of the dominant gender regime, I think that there's a lot of lessons for the way in which a better theorization of war is not only a period of destruction, but is also a period of transformation, the way in which we can really gain a lot of analytical kind of purchase by taking this period of kind of destruction seriously. I also, want to add to the conversation on social movements and contentious politics with this book by talking about how really our traditional sort of more Western understanding of politics obscures really more diffuse and less formal spaces of political mobilization. And so this focus in the book on everyday politics allows, I argue, for a more nuanced and rich understanding of women's lives in particular and how women engage in political life. I think that the book speaks to the women, peace, and security agenda more broadly, which is really a kind of a strong initiative, particularly in the wake of UN Resolution 1325, which was passed in 2000, to include women in all capacities in transitions from violence to stability. And I argue, you know, very strongly that women's inclusion in these transitions is incredibly important and will build more durable peace in the aftermath of armed conflict. But what I think the book shows, and chapter 8 in particular shows, is that oftentimes this process is complicated, and the way in which international actors have traditionally championed women's inclusion, especially women's inclusion in peace processes or women's inclusion in politics in the aftermath of conflict, is not necessarily sufficient to understanding it's not really capturing in many ways the real strength of women's organizing during war. And so the Rwandan case is really instructive because the inclusion of women in Rwanda's politics is in many ways this distraction from the fact that the state has increasingly kind of become authoritarian over the years, and the way in which the executive and President Paul Kagame have full control over government decisions. The legislature is just in many ways for show. Although I wouldn't go that far, but it is in many ways not a powerful branch of the government. I think that it shows that.